Hello, and welcome to this Clinical Oncology podcast. My name is Catherine Crockett, and today both myself and Saif Ahmad will be joined by Dr. Kevin Franks, Dr. Helen McNair, Professor Marcel Van Herk, and Yatman Tsang to discuss OnTarget 2 updated guidance for image-guided radiotherapy, which was published by the Radiotherapy Board in June 2021. Dr. Kevin Franks is a consultant clinical oncologist and clinical lead of lung oncology at the Leeds Cancer Centre. Image-guided radiotherapy is one of his research interests. Dr. Helen McNair is lead research radiographer at the Royal Marsden NHS Foundation Trust and reader in translational therapeutic radiography at the Institute of Cancer Research in London. Professor Marcel Van Herk is a researcher in radiotherapy physics at the University of Manchester, with a focus on improving the accuracy of radiotherapy, including the use of image guidance. And Yatman Tsang is a consultant therapeutic radiographer at Mount Vernon Cancer Centre in London. Dr. Kevin Franks, Dr. Helen McNair and Professor Marcel Van Herk led on the development of the new guidance document, whilst Yatman Tsang makes use of the guidance during his daily clinical practice. We hope you enjoy the following discussion.
Thank you everybody for joining us today. It's a really fantastic article that you've put together for clinical oncology. And in terms of the discussion today, I thought I'd kick off by just asking a very simple question as to what image-guided radiotherapy is. So Marcel, are you happy to take that?
Yeah, be my pleasure. So just to start out with a very, very simple explanation of radiotherapy, because not all, everybody may be familiar with it. Radiotherapy is basically the killing of cancerous cells in the body by hitting them with radiation. And for the largest part, that is done with external beam radiotherapy, where there is a big machine that can rotate around the patient and point the beams at the target, and that's done from different sides. And that then gives enough dose in the target to kill the tumor cells, and hopefully not so much dose such that there is too much damage close to the tumor. But the problem is that, you know, the tumor is typically inside the body, so you can't see where it is. And actually, the treatment beams themselves are invisible as well. So you're trying to hit an invisible target with an invisible beam, and that's a problem. So that's why there is image guidance. We augment the treatment machine by adding imaging equipment onto the treatment machine. And this is a development that has been going on for the last 30 years or so. And actually started with two-dimensional imaging where you could see the bones, and now three-dimensional imaging such as CT, such that you can see some of the soft tissue, and MR, where you have a very, very clear picture of the internal anatomy. And then you analyze that image, and then you use that image to adjust your treatment. And that is image-guided radiotherapy.
So we know of OnTarget 2 guidance was published last year. And the question is really, why do we need guidance, a guidance document for image-guided radiotherapy?
Certainly when image guidance, the technology came on and evolved, then actually we needed some guidance on how to use it, because it was being provided to many radiotherapy departments, but we needed some consensus and to use it widely. And I did a survey many years ago with the College of Radiographers, and it showed that like image guidance protocols varied. There was about 20 different protocols for image verification of the prostate, and by that I mean, do you take the image one day, make an adjustment, do an image the next day, or do you do it once a week or every other day? It was incredibly varied. So it was really to get a sort of consensus and then guidance with people getting new technology and wondering how to actually apply it and use it wisely and effectively and efficiently.
Do you have anything you want to add, Kevin?
Yeah, I think the other thing was, often when it first came out, we had to, particularly in the event of cone beam CT, we only had one or two machines per unit, or per centre, sorry. So we had to then work out which sites benefited the most initially. So I think that was one of the drivers for it. And then going forward, I think people have technology, and I think we're guilty of this in radiotherapy as any other specialty. You see, it looks better, so it must be better. We need to implement it without really much thought sometimes, or how to do it in the best possible way, the most efficient way. So I think on target, initial on target, laid out some very good, clear guidelines on how to do image-guided radiotherapy, and really on target too. And in between that, the NCAT guidelines said was try to adapt that to new technology. So the principles are very similar, if not identical, but it's how to then use technology. I think going forward, this is only get more. I'm sure Marcel and Helen will talk about that, particularly with the experience of MR-Linux.
And I think if I can just add, I think I've been in radiotherapy a very long time, so I remember doing port films. And then we got image technology that was integrated into the machine. And I think then from port films where you took an image until you got it right and then you stopped. So then you had a device that you could take an image every day, but we didn't really know how to use it or what to do with it. So often, and I think we are a bit, if I can be broad, we often sometimes apply how we do things in an old way to new technology, and really we need to look at it afresh. So that's the other thing the document did. So for the anyone who's lay listener, it's a bit like using a camera that you had to process a film, and then using a digital camera where you see the image instantly and you can do something with it, like send it to someone else, can actually act on it.
That's great. Catherine, can I jump in to ask a follow-up question, if that's okay?
Of course, yeah.
That's great. So actually for Helen, Kevin and myself, I think, you know, because you guys done such a brilliant job for On Target too. Because Kevin mentioned from On Target, you know, from 2008, and then we move on to the NREG iJudge report in 2012. And now we got On Target 2 last year. You know, we see that the evolutions and the development of the guidance. And for me, that I see is because it's so comprehensive and it's so nicely written. Do you have any concerns that people just see it like, you know, IGRT Bible and follow it step by step? Because for me, that, you know, and Helen and I've been talking about quite a lot of times that, you know, sometimes when it's great to have a protocol, but sometimes when everything is so protocolized, make us stop reacting as a profession. So I don't know if any of you would like to comment on that point.
Yeah, that's a very, very nice question. And thank you for the praise. But I don't think On Target is really a protocol. You know, it describes how it can be done, what issues you should be aware of, and it's more of an aid to use when you're developing your protocols. And in that sense, I do not think it stops you thinking. I think it really should start you thinking about the protocols. And then in-house, you should make them perfect for your situation.
And just to add to Marcel's comment, I think, you know, even with On Target, where they said you should be doing institutional margins, reassessing it, how many centres do that routinely? So this is really a framework to try and get your IGRT and suggestions. And I think we have to be honest, in a lot of the things we've done, there isn't robust evidence for what we've done. We've tried to do it as a consensus of best practice. So I wouldn't see it as a Bible. I would see it as a guidelines to frame your own centre.
Yes, I think of it as a tool to help you make your clinical judgments, I hope.
No, definitely. I think, you know, and guys, I think, you know, definitely On Target too, I see that there's a much bigger component on the educations and how do you set your union house program to assess, as Marcel said, that, you know, what is the most suitable tools and what is the most suitable protocol for different clinical settings, you know. So definitely, I think, you know, that I can see that, you know, definitely is a very, very comprehensively written in that sense. So thank you.
I think you make a very good point, though. Yeah, I think sometimes we just want answers, and often there isn't a binary answer.
Thank you. That's a really important point to bring out early on, really, that this is certainly a guidance document rather than a Bible, putting it in Yat's words. I guess in terms of the updates, then, we've kind of talked about there have been a few different documents that have looked at this. So what would you all as authors say are some of the key updates in On Target 2 compared to previous iterations? I don't know, Kevin, if you wanted to kick off on that.
I'll leave the experts to give a talk for me. So I think we wanted to make it a bit more contemporary in terms of the big difference between On Target and On Target 2 was volumetric imaging, particularly cone beam imaging, which had gone from being very rare in On Target to most centres had a couple of images, it's cone beam CTs, when the NREG guidelines came out, and now most centres have quite a lot of image guidance. So I think it was to reflect the volumetric era that we're in, and clearly other things have happened in terms of imaging. Pre-imaging and sort of 4D CT became more online, And clearly, adaptive ray therapy, and we'll talk about probably a little bit later, has become more widely adopted. We can agree to discussion how well it's done and how should it be done. And things like MR Linux, you know, we have two centers with MR Linux, which, you know, again, is another way forward. And we tried to make the guidelines to allow for that. Ultrasound imaging was also included as well, because I think there's been a huge change, and technology has evolved so much in the past 10 years and will continue to evolve as we go forward.
Thank you. Marcel, anything to add on that?
Yeah, I actually thought that there was a little bit of complexity there, because, you know, just obviously you want to talk about all the newest things, but but by doing that, I think you run the risk of making a report that is first not very usable, because many people will not have all the latest and the greatest, and second, that is probably quite soon outdated, because a lot of the things that we are experimenting now and may think is a good idea might disappear in a year or two, while the techniques that have been used a little bit longer, such as combing CT, you know, they're here, and they're here to stay, and I think we could give more definitive guidance about them. So I think we struggled, but I think we found a reasonable balance between dealing with the most widely used techniques in more detail and giving a little bit of detail on what's coming.
And Helen, from your point of view, what do you think were some of the key updates?
Yes, the addition of a chapter on adaptive radiotherapy, and that included plan of the day from a library of plans, I think was good. And also, Marcel in particular put a lot of effort into updating the margin recipe chapter, which was, I think, really important, and really practical examples was good. And I think, as Marcel said, I would agree with that, all the actually much more detail about about comb beam CT.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that.
So what were some of the key learning points when putting the update together? Marcel, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I think a very important one is that I'd like to stress, and I think that we made come across quite good in this report, is that radiotherapy is really a total chain of activities, and it starts with the clinician, the physicist play a role, the radiographers play a role, and image guidance is just one or a couple of links in the chain. And I think people tended to get carried away and think that, yeah, with this new equipment will be perfectly accurate. And I think that is, for me, is the most important learning point of this report. You know, look at it as a total chain, talk to all the disciplines and take all the uncertainties into account, because otherwise you're going to overestimate how accurate everything is.
I think the multidisciplinary aspect was just absolutely essential in a report like this, because so often we all look at things with a slightly different perspective. And yes, I think, you know, certainly between the three of us, Kevin, Marcel and I, we often have the same outcome or same opinion, but we look at it all with a different perspective. And I think that's absolutely essential. And it was great that we were able to do that here, and also use so many opinions from around the country. We tried to engage different people from different centres, and different centres, size of centres, was really good.
Kevin or Yat, would you add anything else to that?
I think just to add on top of that, you know, the way we did it made it slightly longer to do, but the fact we went out and invited anybody who was interested to submit an application meant we did get a broad church of centres, size, equipment, and that, I think, hope that's reflected in the document. And the other thing I think we should also assess is having somebody like Gillian Dollimore from the college getting us together and help us write it was one of the big things to make him. That was a fantastic benefit, because I think without Gillian sort of marshalling us three to get going, it wouldn't have been got together in the time. So I think a special mention for her.
Yeah, I think I just want to echo the points that, you know, as a reader, you know, to read the report, I definitely see that come across really well about the multidisciplinary aspect, as Hannah mentions, because the composition of the steering group and the working group, and then definitely we see that, you know, every professions that involve in the pathway, actually they have the perspectives represented, you know, at the report. So I think that come across, the message definitely is very loud and clear within On Target 2. So thank you.
That's fantastic. I guess with any kind of document, then you've said that you've reached out to people. So were there any kind of areas that you thought the consensus was almost sort of impossible to come at, or you were kind of surprised by some of the variability that was coming through? I don't know, Helen, if you wanted to go first on that.
We were thinking about this earlier. I think, Marcel, we were thinking of deformable registration. Maybe you want to take that, where it was a bit harder to get a consensus about something new. It was difficult to get to think of evidence for some of the things we were saying, because often we now use the technology, so it's hard to then go back and find the evidence. So I think that for me, that was one of the hardest things, to try and say why we shouldn't do something all the time, for example. But I'll hand over to Marcel to talk about the deformable registration.
Well, I think what we've done in the report is advocate to be very, very careful with some of the new technology, because the technology gives you a number or an answer on a question is what dose have you given to the patient, but nobody knows how accurate that answer is. And so we spent quite a few sentences in the report to warn against that. You know, you can use these kind of tools for research, but not really in clinical practice, because they're not well established enough, or not well evaluated enough. And actually, I don't think it was very difficult to get consensus about that. Yeah, I think people, when once explained, I think the people on the working group saw the issues, and I think we're happy with that.
I think we also had quite a lot of, the way it was set out with sort of site groups, each had a multidisciplinary team, so that often those things were resolved in that team. And then when there were issues, that went through the steering group, and then there's quite a lot of dialogue back and forth. So I don't think we had anything that we had, as Helen said, the key thing is when we recommended daily image guidance for some set sites, and we had to be honest, the evidence for that was not great, but because it seemed the right thing to do, we often, we went down that route. So I think some of the, and that may be some implications for the consensus to look at the guide and say, why are you doing image guidance rate there, but there's no evidence, particularly daily image guided. So I suppose that's a controversy that we haven't resolved, but we've accepted in the guidelines. And I think we never made it mandatory. We just, I think we were very clear in all the site-specific things to make sure it was recommended rather than you must, you could.
That's really helpful. And I guess one question related to then the guidance is that would you say this guidance is more for the UK, or would you say that everything within it could be extrapolated internationally, or are there caveats to that?
I think, if I may take that, I think there are quite some differences between different countries on how it's done, but the basic principles are really the same. So I hope this report will be read internationally and be used internationally, because it would be silly not to. You know, the patients are the same, the equipment is the same, the disciplines are almost the same. I think there might be slight differences between countries, but I think it is a very good guidance document that can be used all over the world, and that's beautiful that it's also freely downloadable. You know, that's a lot of the reports, that's not the case, so I think that's really good.
I think from memory, the original on target document was one of the most downloaded documents ever on the ICR website. That's, again, partly because it was free to access and it was addressing the key issues. So I just say, I'd echo what Marcel said, that I think, you know, these guidelines, the principles are there for any centre, any country, but I hope it will be appropriately used elsewhere.
So at the start, I mentioned obviously On Target 2 was only published last year, but which should we expect an On Target 3, and if so, when?
I was going to say, not on my watch.
Or mine.
So I've been involved in all of them, and I really hope that what we've written now, not just because of that, will be quite robust, but surely as technology advances, there will need to be more guidelines, but hopefully they should be robust for quite a few years.
Yeah, and if I may add to that, you know, I'm on several committees, like the APM committee on motion management. And then I think, well, I'm still talking about this stuff, you know, we've been working on that for 20 years and that's boring. So no, it's not boring, you know, it's really interesting. But at a certain point, you're done with a certain topic. So I think, you know, with the equipment and the technology, maybe image guidance is now really not the biggest issue. And so I'm just become part of a working group that's looking at the clinical target volume definition and the biological uncertainty that surrounds the tumor. And no image guidance is ever going to solve that. So I think that should become a hot topic, because we've got a little bit ahead of ourselves with all this beautiful technology, but some of the core principles are still quite vague.
And adaptive radiotherapy would be, we're all playing around with that as well. But who knows how often we need to use it, how we should be using it, and who we should be using it on. Yeah, that will definitely need some guidance later.
Out of interest, how long did it take from start to finish?
I think my folder says IGRT 2017. No, it took a longer time because when Kevin and I first agreed to do it, I think it was it roughly then, Kevin? But then we tried to get a bigger working party to, because we were very conscious that we'd done the one in 2012. And I don't think it's good for the same people to do the same subject. I think it's good to have fresh eyes on it. So that's what we wanted to do. And we also wanted to make it very collaborative and involve a lot of people. So all of that took time, plus obviously doing it in your spare time takes time. And then, but once we got Marcel on board, then it was, we tried to meet every now and again, and that was useful for one day and do a lot. And then Gillian would help us and keep going. So I've no idea how many hours that was.
But I think that also when teams became more online, we do often have meetings via teams, and that was not as nice as meeting up in person. I'm not sure it was productive, but it definitely helped us get over the game line and finish it. But I think there was inherent delays in the initial way how we tried to get people on board in the application process. But I think hopefully the guidelines reflect that you know, it is very broad and has lots of different opinions that come together to form a consensus.
But I definitely have very warm memories to our sessions together. It was always a great pleasure, even though the report looked like a mountain to get through. Yeah, the people that we're working with, really nice.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I just want to say that, you know, thanks, guys, that we do know that what happened in the past 24 months, we do have COVID. So, you know, with on top of your normal daily job that you're still able to, you know, finish off the report, I think that's a really big achievement. So I think, you know, thank you for you guys to be persistent and pursuing and pushing the report to the finish line. So thank you.
Well, thank Gillian.
The only downside, you want to make downside code, we haven't had a chance to meet up and celebrate yet. So that's our next plan this summer.
And some very good bottles of wine.
Yes, definitely.
Definitely.
And Steph and Catherine, if I can ask a kind of follow-up questions to the group, I think Helen and Kevin and myself, you lure into that, you know, it seems that, you know, the guidance there, you know, you cover most of the aspect. Is this any aspect within on target 3 that you think that, you know, that we could work on a bit more? And as Marcel, you're looking to about, you know, the target volume delineations, do you think that the AI will play a big part in the next versions of the guidance that, you know, more not how to use it, is how can we, if we want to implement AI into radiotherapy, is it something that a keynote consideration that we should pay attention to?
Well, yeah, I think I can answer that a little bit. I think the main problem that we see now with the systems that are arriving is that it takes an awful lot of time to treat a patient. If you have these online adaptive systems, even they're totally AI driven, you know, the physician will still come up to the machine and do some editing. And the reason why that is because I think in the whole discipline, nobody really understands uncertainties very well. So do we need to edit the last millimeter of like a rectum or a bladder, or is it fine as it is? And nobody can answer that question because we don't have the knowledge how to deal with it. And that's an issue that I've been interested in for a very long time, and you know, with the margin recipe and such, and modern planning system. And I think that we kind of needs a revolution, you know, that people starting to really think in terms of error bars and think, okay, well, even if it's a millimeter off, I don't need to edit it. And that can make the whole thing a lot more efficient and bring it to more widespread use. But that is a big, big jump that needs to be taken. And you know, since no two clinicians will agree on a contour, no clinician will ever agree with an AI system doing it. So it's an element. It's a really, really fundamental problem that needs a lot of work to deal with.
Thanks, Marcel. Actually, I just want to follow that up with Helen, because I think, you know, one thing that I think, Helen, you enlightened me a lot about patient voice, because I think one statement that you mentioned before that, you know, we're so focusing on the accuracy and sometimes we forget about a patient comfort. And one of the statements that you mentioned is really, really strong that is still like, you know, I would say still keep very close to my heart. It's about, you know, have you ever asked the patients, you know, do they really want to struggled the whole treatment for an hour for that, we think that's 1% gain of the accuracy. I don't know if Helen, do you want to comment on that?
That's a really good question, and we have talked to my patient and public involvement group of my NIHR grant about that, about how they would be able would they like to have that choice. You know, I'd rather have the treatment done quicker, but and I'll sacrifice a little bit of whatever for that, and it's how to get it across, and also that do you want to put that responsibility on the patient to make that decision then, and then they might, you know, regret it later or not. But then actually, does it make, I think what Marcel said is a really good example of what I was saying earlier. We're trying to cram the whole workflow onto the MR Linac because we've got this new machine, but we're doing exactly what we always do every day. So we're trying to put 2 weeks worth of work. But if we'd been given that machine and we hadn't done anything before, would we have been using it like we are? Because, you know, one little error or one little sort of contour mishap one day is, how different is that going to make it? What I'm trying to say is the errors online are very different to the errors offline, I think. Do you know what I'm trying to say, Marcel? I didn't say that very clearly.
I think the other thing is that we don't know the consequences of these little errors. So trying to hand that back to the patient is really difficult. So I think, you know, as I said before, the evidence for IGRT in terms of outcomes is not great in many sites. So then trying to give a patient an option is, when we don't know the consequence of the two decisions they might make, is really, really challenging. And I think in general terms, is, you know, we often get sold on technology. We get so sold on the technology and the imaging quality and everything we can do, we forget perhaps the cancer biology sometimes. And the more accurate we get, are we actually going to deliver better outcomes for our patients? So we have to be careful with that. I think, Marcel, as you made a point earlier, you know, sometimes we get, the more conformal we get, actually the results maybe not as good as they were when we were less conformal.
Yeah, I was just discussing that with Corinne Vervre-Finn, our lung clinician and professor in my group. And she was saying that the Americans are starting to get rid of the CTV in lung cancer treatment, so they're really, really shrinking the margins. While in the most precise treatments that we have, we see more and more evidence that actually, if you give a little bit more dose or splash a little bit more dose outside the target, actually you see better survival. So yeah, so we're missing a trick here, and the problem is that we don't really understand the biology. And I truly think that is now the limiting factor, but obviously that for most sites, maybe not for all the sites. In some sites, the, you know, you can still gain in technical accuracy, but in many sites, I think that is you're at a diminishing gains level.
Thank you. That was really a really interesting discussion, and I guess coming towards the end of the podcast and trying to look forward. If it's okay with you, just going through sort of one by one if you're able to share, you know, what area sort of excites you most about not just IGRT, I guess, about sort of radiation treatment in general, and where you think the most advances will be made. So, I'll start off with you as sort of joining the group today. Well, what's really exciting you?
Thanks, Seth. I think the exciting thing, as Helen said, I would say for the next 5 years is about how we really adapt our treatment. Because at the moment, I would say that, you know, adaptive radiotherapy that we all got, I'm not saying we've got to put in a box, but I think, you know, we have quite a steady pace to get on. But I think adaptive radiotherapy, how they're going to evolve, that, you know, as myself say, that, you know, how can we integrate biology into adaptive radiotherapy? I think that will be a really exciting path for us to go down to.
Fantastic. And Kevin?
God, that's a really difficult question because there's so many things are happening. I think I'll leave us there. I mean, I think just from a general perspective, the integration of radiotherapy with new systemic agents and the potential side effects of those, I think this document allows us to perhaps be able to more quantify that and also look at early toxicity. So we already saw in the COVID era, you could pick up people on COVID-CT who had COVID. So whether we should be using these images for more biological information as well. So I think there's a broad, you know, so much can happen and so much will happen in the next few years in terms of radiotherapy and technical development. But I think as Marcel points, the biology and how we integrate that with systemic agents is going to be key things going forward.
Thank you. And Helen, how about yourself?
Yeah, I agree with you. For me, the adaptive radiotherapy, that's been the biggest game changer, I think, in my career. And it would be really interesting to see how we continue to use it. And can we look at things afresh, like, you know, patient preparation and all the things we put the patient through? Can we just get them on the bed, let them be comfortable and go for it? We don't have to have things the same every day, maybe being a bit radical. But it would be just so much nicer for them if they didn't have to worry so much.
Helen, am I hearing that you're saying that we don't need patient immobilization and we don't need care how we align them?
You're mishearing me. They need to be comfortable and relaxed, but not try and force them into some sort of position that they're never going to reproduce again. And then we get the perfect CT scan, and then the per patient can never reproduce that. I think we should just go with them and let them be a lot more, but absolutely not forget about it, Marcel. You know me better than that.
And Marcel, what excites you most?
Yeah, I think it's actually maybe not so much the new technology at this point in time, but it's looking at the big data aspects of it. You know, what can you learn from the patients that we've done in the past? Can we figure out what went well and what went less well in those patients? And for instance, learn how we can better define our target volume. What is really the most critical part of the treatment? I think that is a very exciting development. And actually, I've got quite a nice group working on those aspects. And it's also very complicated, which is nice because it keeps us off the street.
But yeah, I think with the group, actually, I just don't know what the group feel as well, because I think with the technologies, what I see that is it gives us a confidence really push forward about the ultra fractionations, because I definitely see for the past 5 years, we're really pushing the agenda forward. And then I think because we see more and we're more confident about what we're targeting, and I don't know how the group feel about, you know, the utilizations of ultra fractionations in quite a lot of different tumor sites now. I think for Kevin, that thing, I would say 5 years ago, we would never thought about single fractions for lung radiotherapy. With COVID, I think that make, you know, that happened in the UK. And how do you feel about that?
I think, I mean, obviously, hyperfractionation is here to stay, I think, in many sites. I think, you know, flash radiotherapy may be coming. And there's lots of things happening in terms of how we deliver radiotherapy, and that may change going forward. We've now got two proton centers established. So again, that opens a door for again hyperfractionation. But I think going back to our core principle, we need to understand the biology better to make the advantage. And I think, you know, you can argue between 1 in 5, 3 fractions. It's probably the same technology, the same image guidance. It's just the confidence to do it. But again, we have to be really conscious when we go forward and make these big changes that we're doing it based on evidence rather than just because we can. And I think that's the key thing going forward is, you know, we're going to see huge changes. You know, we're going to have more data, more processing time. We'll be able to do things much quicker. But is that we have to, we've been conscious in the past of not just saying this is the right thing to do. And I think we have to question ourselves as we go forward. It's easy to believe the technology.
Yeah, and I really think we need our clinical trials for this because there are so many things that go right in radiotherapy, and because we've done them right, or we learned to do them right over very, very long periods of time. And then we think we understand what we're doing, but you know, we're not necessarily understand it. And if we change it, all of a sudden, we're bitten by our lack of understanding. So, you know, I was just thinking, you know, if you give a single fraction, is actually the tumor going to reoxygenate enough for the dormant cells to wake up and be radiosensitive? You know, these kind of things. We don't really know that. So these things really need to be tried out in clinical trials.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, really insightful comments there. I don't know if any Catherine or anyone else had any other questions or comments at this point.
No, I don't have any other questions, but that was very interesting. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. And clearly the piece of work on Target itself is you know, going to have global impact. So yeah, really appreciate what you've done. Thank you very much.